My guest in the studio today is Dominic Johnson, who is, and I'm going to use the terms sports commentator, reporter, presenter and editor, because it sounds like the sort of job that a lot of young people give their eye teeth to have. Is it as exciting as I'm making it out to seem?
It's jack of all trades and master of none. Yes, you can look at it as glamorous at times. You meet people who have high profiles, people who are involved in events and matches or tournaments that will capture the imagination of the public. It's also hard work, and that's the side of it that people don't see. So, yes, a game of football lasts 90 minutes, but if you've got to drive 6 hours to get to it, and you've got to be there 3 hours before, and you're there 2 hours afterwards, then you drive home, that's still quite a long day.
Okay, but of course, life never starts at the end, it starts at the beginning. And for you, that meant, like everybody else, deciding what you're going to do, what you're going to study. In your case, you studied what?
Performing arts, although I'm still deciding what I want to do. And I just kind of fell into it. I did music at school. I had a brilliant, inspirational, genius music teacher who taught me at school, who probably taught me more doing A-level music than I'd learnt at university in terms of theory. The guy was just an absolute genius. So that's where I just ended up falling into. And that gave me a wide exposure to a lot of things around performing arts, standing up on stage, talking, also behind the scenes, directing shows, conducting musicals, business sides of things as well. So it was a wide-ranging course, which sadly is no longer running, but it was brilliant at the time, and I really enjoyed it.
At that stage, did you have any idea that what you really wanted to do was to get involved with sport, or was it just general? Was performing arts is quite a general term, could lead you into theatre, it could lead you into the media or other sorts. Why sport?
It was music and football for me. So I played the trumpet. That's what I majored in, classical performance on my degree. I realised I wasn't good enough to ever play in an orchestra. Didn't want to teach music for a thousand reasons, spending more time with kids who don't want to be with you, probably the major one. And football, I just fell into. I'd started by having a year out and working in a local radio station in Birmingham, BRNB, and just got involved in the football programmes there, really enjoyed it. And those were the two things. So I didn't really know when I finished university what I wanted to do, but going back and working in radio, I was involved in the studio, helping produce programmes, but then I wanted to go and watch games. And then I ended up getting the opportunity to report on matches, and it just snowballed from there.
One of the things that a previous guest of mine, Martin Croxall, said that she went to do some work experience and found that shortly after, she actually had to present when she had no experience of presenting the news or whatever it was that she was doing in a local radio station. Did you find yourself falling into aspects of what you're doing that you didn't expect?
There were times, one in particular, I was working in Birmingham and BRNB was bought by Capital Radio and got more involved in what was going on with Capital Gold Sports, came down, started on the Monday, and on the Friday, the number two commentator, Steve Wilson, who works on Match of the Day now, resigned. So Jonathan Pierce, who's now on Match of the Day as well, who was my boss, said, right, you're number two commentator. And it was a bit of a, to quote Sir Alex Ferguson, squeaky bum moment. It just snowballed from there. That was literally being in the right place at the right time. You can look at it that way. But there was 5 or 6 years of hard work that preceded it. So yes, things, opportunities came, but I think you earn those opportunities from what you do. And yeah, there is an element of fortune about it.
You said that before you went to the university course, you got to work experience,
yeah,
which was in radio. And you used that year to find whether it worked for you. Is that what you're trying to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think I originally, go back even further, I wanted to be a sound engineer, but you needed A-level physics. And for someone who maths is not a natural bedfellow, that was never, ever going to happen. Now you don't need that. It's understanding, you know, how you edit things together and how you balance microphones. And so it's a different skill now. But at that time, you needed A-level physics. There was never a chance that I was ever going to get that. So that route blocked off. But I enjoyed the editorial side of it. And I think that came about by working on the Archers, on a work experience, which nearly ended disastrously when we went to the club at lunchtime, Pebble Mill. And I seemed to turn up with the theme on quarter-inch tape and lost it somewhere in the bar in Pebble Mill, and eventually they found it. So my media career nearly ended before it started by losing the theme tune to the Archers.
So you got something in Birmingham, and then you moved into to London for the next step, is that right?
Yep, Capital asked me to go and work down there. Having been involved when London clubs were up in the Midlands, I'd double up really, and they asked me to come down. That was the start of things really getting going. It's a great place to work. London football is complicated. It's very passionate. You really have to get to know people. And once you do that, it's a little village, and it's good.
So when you use the term sports commentator, you really, football is the thing you do. You don't do athletics or cricket or whatever.
I have reported on that in the past, but I would say 90% of the work that I've done is football based.
So I know that you're working now for lots of different organisations, yeah. And you have worked for a lot, but they've all been in the football arena. But you've developed a whole range of skills. You started in the back room with, yep, your first experience. You found yourself thrown into the front room when you were a second commentator. Yep. But now, is that mainly what you do, presenting or commentating, or do you do other things?
It's a mixture of things. I think the main thing is you're still reporting and or commentating. So there are two different strands to it. So you commentate on live matches. I've spent a lot the last few years covering European games, particularly stuff from Spain and from the Netherlands. That stuff gets sent around the world or is used exclusively in this country. So a lot of the work you do might not actually be heard in this country. That's commentating on live matches, which on television is a very different skill to commentating on the radio. If you have the images in front of you and you're supporting and trying to enhance what those images are in radio, you're creating those images as well. And so the idea of radio is theatre of the mind. You're much more descriptive in the way that you describe a player and what's going on and the whole scene and the whole picture that's in front of you. So that's one part of it. The other part is reporting on what's happened. So working on goals highlights packages. So I work for the past few years for Sky Sports on their EFL coverage and rounding up what's been going on there. That's a very different set of skills. That's working journalistically, trying to find stories that have come out of the game and linking them going forward as well. So it's retrospective, whereas the live commentary is in the moment as it happens. So it's a very different skill set. And also what's changed is how people consume the media. People watch not just on TV, but they'll watch on mobile devices, on iPads, tablets and phones as well. If you're working for a product that's exclusively digital in that sense, for a tablet, you have to tailor the content because people won't see as much necessarily because the screen's smaller than the screen you'd watch at home. So how you deliver that is different. And you just have to mould and adapt it and just really embrace the technology and see how that's developed over the last 5 years from companies who had online highlights where you'd sit at your computer screen, press play and it would come up. Now you can just grab it on your phone as people are on the go and you have to get people's attention much more quickly and persuade them to keep watching. Reacting to that, how people consume the products is key, I think, to having a career.
That's not something you can learn in a book. That's something that comes with experience, is it?
One job I had was I was at Capital and they bought a group of radio stations up in the north, one of which was working with Manchester United. We went up there and it was a mess. We were parachuted in to sort it out. And we did some attitudinal research. They had an exclusive contract with Manchester United. The attitudinal research showed that they weren't regarded as the place to go for authoritative information about Manchester United. Now, if you spend all that money and there's a significant six-figure amount on that contract, but your audience don't respect you, then effectively you're wasting a huge amount of that money. So it's trying to create content which is believable, is true, is authoritative and credible at the same time so that you can have that relationship with the fans so that they know when you say something, it's true or that it's likely to happen. There may be a spanner in the works which prevents something, a transfer, say, as an example, happening further down the line. But at the point you give that information out, it's right. Attitudinal research is crucial. If you're working in digital technologies, you can tell how long people are listening for or watching for and when they turn off. You can then tailor how you get people into that content to make it more appealing and get them to watch for longer.
Research in general is presumably quite important. When I was as amused and amazed that the commentator knows the names of all the players, how do you do it, especially with foreign, with European and other leagues?
Is research. I'd say to do a commentary would probably be about 10 to 12 hours worth of research before you even turn up. That would be a mixture of form, current form that the team are in, just looking at how they're doing over the season, bits of information about that. It can be basic stuff like how many penalties they've scored, how many times they've come back from the losing position, how many times they've dropped points in games. And you can look at that. Players are in form at the moment. Then you would look at how they've done historically against each other and look at that. And are there any standout games over the recent years? I did a championship game recently where I think it was Blackburn and Wigan beat Blackburn a few years ago and it relegated Blackburn and Wigan stayed up. So for fans, that was a huge match. Having been able to reference things like that which link you to the supporters and what's the basis of the game and the heart and the soul of the match is really important. And then you would have details of all the squad, probably have about 10 pieces of information about each player: height, weight, how long the contract is, what the scoring form is, how they've done historically against the team they're playing against, are there any links between them, and trying to find all those bits of information, which is fine when it's all spread out in front of you on pieces of paper. The trick is being able to use it at the right time. That time comes, you use it accurately and make it relevant. relevant. That type of research is different to how audiences consume what you're creating and what you're delivering. There's two very different sides to it.
And does the commentator or the reporter do his or her own research, or is there a team in the background which helps?
There's a mixture of both, depending on who you're working for. There are times when you get a lot of support for things that you're doing, and then you might not on others. But there are always sources of information that you can go to that I use regularly, which are probably quite niche and designed for people and myself.
You've talked about negotiating or discussing with Manchester United when the previous contractual setup was not working quite well. Do you get involved in talking much with the clubs themselves? I mean, is that part of the game? Are you allowed into the changing room and talk to them and get to know the players?
There's two separate things there. There's a business relationship, which you would have as a broadcaster. I don't get involved in that now. I have done. I've negotiated contracts in the past. That's a standard business thing. That's a relationship, and you would decide what you're going to offer and whether they're going to accept that and then work out a deal from there. That's not rocket science. That's relationships, as most contracts are, and you'd work it through that way. In terms of relationships with the players, I feel that the gap between reporters and players is getting bigger. I understand why clubs protect an asset like a footballer and wrap them up in cotton wool, but you don't have that same relationship between players that you would have had historically. You don't have that two-way conversation, and that, I think, gives you a lack of trust. You know, I remember talking to an Arsenal player. We were just chatting after a game, and he was saying he was exhausted. It was his new child had kept him awake the night before. I'm not going to use that necessarily as a story, but it just gives you an understanding that people who are effectively ordinary people in extraordinary jobs are exactly that, ordinary people. They still have the same worries that you or I would have, but they just live in a different world. If you can have that relationship, then it's much easier. But I think that's much harder for people out and about now, trekking up and down the country covering games, to have those relationships with players and managers.
There's a lot of money in football, huge amounts of money in football now. The players, they're immensely wealthy for a period of time.
Yeah.
They feel themselves separate and apart. Sometimes they've been accused of being apart from the fans even.
I don't begrudge them the money, one jot. I think to be an elite athlete and an elite footballer is really tough. And the sacrifices they've made, fair play, if you can earn that money, go and grab it. Whether it's right or wrong is a totally different issue. But they have worked, and it is a tough, rough and tumble industry they're involved in. They physically put themselves on the line. An injury could end their career. Is there a gap between football fans and people earning that amount of money? There inevitably will be.
But it's always been that way.
They've always earned good money. And so they've always earned disproportionately more than the average yearly salary. But the gap now is astronomical. And I think with that perhaps comes an element of caution and trepidation. They don't want to be ripped off by people. They don't want to be taken advantage of. And you totally understand that. But if you don't have the relationship as a journalist trying to cover what they're doing, then it's really hard and you can't close that gap down. I think the England team in the World Cup in Russia is probably a really good example, where they deliberately held a press day where a lot of European teams, the Dutch were fantastic for this. You'd go to a Dutch press conference and all the players would be sat at desks. You work your way round and just sit and have a chat. They're normal people, they just happen to play football. And the FA seemed to do something very similar in Russia last year. And I think that helped repair a broken bond of trust between the fans and the team. And it was up to the team to go out and perform well and show England football fans that, yes, we are proud, we are passionate, we're patriotic, we really are desperate to do well. Don't think that's ever been in doubt. But I think that trust and that line between them had broken down. I think that was very, very good. Before the England team went to Brazil, I happened to be having lunch at the Grove, a birthday lunch, and the England team were flying out. And the England players, I understand, were told not to engage with the fans or have photos taken as they walked from the hotel onto the coach. Why they were told that, I have no idea. If you don't allow people those interactions, then that gap becomes a chasm. So hopefully with the England team, we've seen that you can close that down. It may filter down through to Premier League clubs.
One of the things you indicated earlier is that you work for a number of different organisations, both consecutively and in parallel. You are still working for various different things. That's effectively, you're a freelance, presumably, or self-employed.
In that. Self-employed, so I'm a business in itself.
What are the stresses of being self-employed in something as dynamic as a sports world? Do you like being freelance?
I've done it for 20 years. So do I like it? Yeah, I wouldn't carry on doing it. There are pressures, but you have to accept those pressures. If the pressure of insecurity is something you can't handle, and the insecurity of not knowing whether you're keeping working and you can't handle that, then that's not the world for you. You need to go down something else. But if you think of it, you're running a business. The only difficulty is, say, compared to a plumber, is that my marketplace is very small. So it's about, a lot of it, it's about relationships with the people who have the rights holders to show the content to give you the opportunity to work. So if you have those relationships, then hopefully over time, they'll keep emailing you, ringing you and asking you to do things.
You can't knock on their door and say, hey, get a job.
You can, say no. Yeah, I mean, there are times when you can, times when you can't. There have been times where I've had elements of exclusivity about who I can and who I can't work for. Sure. But generally, everyone's sensible. Just get on with it. But if you couldn't run your own business, whatever it may be, and deal with the pressure of knowing that you need to generate work and to generate income, then it probably isn't the best way for you to work. But there are plenty of staff jobs around that you could go for.
You got your way into this business through, to some extent, chance, to some extent, determination, because you wanted to get into the football, you wanted to get into the sports area, and you took some work experience, you're volunteering, you did a few other things. Is that how it is today? Is it going to be that way again, still, or have things changed?
Things have changed that there's a proliferation of media courses around, and I'm sure most of them are very worthwhile. But I was talking to an intern at a major broadcaster, and we were just chatting away, and he was explaining to me what he was doing as part of this apprenticeship, internship. It was quite a structured program. And I said to him, you know, a lot of what you have to do is deadlines. You have to learn about deadlines. And he said, what do you mean? I said, well, if you sit down to watch the 6 o'clock news, it has to be ready. The top story has to be ready for 6 o'clock. It doesn't matter. It has to be ready. You can't have the news at 3 minutes past six and expect someone to sit there for 3 minutes twiddling their thumbs. And that idea of deadlines is something that I think you need to get into the media courses. Yes, people need to learn in a safe and structured environment, which is supportive. But ultimately, a lot of the media in sport, it's instant. You need to be able to say, this has been the result. This is the halftime score. You can't have 25 minutes to write a full-time report. You've got to be able to do it quickly. So in getting that element across to people for live broadcasting, I think is crucial, as well as some theories about filming techniques. You know, they're equally as valid. But I think if you're out on the streets, you need to be able to look somebody in the eye and ask them why the team are rubbish and are they going to get the sack, and know that, you know, there is a chance they might not like it. I remember speaking to Roy Keane the morning after Thierry Henry had handled the ball in the to deny the Republic of Ireland qualification for the World Cup. And we were about 8:30 in the morning. He was doing an interview he didn't want to do. He was grumpy because of the handball. He was grumpy because he didn't really want to do the interview, but he did it. So he sat there and he stared at me. It was not nice. So I just looked down and thought, right, I've got a choice here. I just stare back at him and see what happens. And so I did. I mean, he was fine. But then I started prodding him verbally about the Thierry Henry thing. And that stare got even harder and harder. And I kind of know what was going on in the tunnel at Highbury that day when he started having a go at the Arsenal players. So, yeah, you get moments like that. But you need to be able to teach people, how do you handle that? How do you manage those situations, which you could find yourself in? But again, much of that is experience. So media courses are good, but they have to show people and teach people what it's really like when you're out working. Because if you don't, I'm not sure you're giving them the best opportunity as they go forward.
What's next? Where do you go next?
You carry on and just embrace the changes.
You've obviously grappled with and understood the changes into digital that has come in your working time.
Yeah.
And that will keep on changing?
I'd imagine it will. I mean, the way that technology is changing, I've no idea how it will develop. But the way people consume the content will change. Behind the scenes, that may change. I don't know how people who own the rights, say the Football Association, the Premier League or FIFA, how they decide to sell their product to a broadcaster or a media company. I don't know. That will change over the years. That will develop. It has done constantly and it will continue to do so. But embracing that change is part of it, isn't it? It's about knowing that people are watching goals highlights very quickly on their tablets. That's great. Fantastic that you're able to super serve football fans. Get involved in that. That's equally as important as writing 500 words to go in a national newspaper about a match. It's just understanding that and taking it all on board and enjoying it and hopefully allowing the stories to come out. And just that's what I like, grabbing hold of the stories. A manager, Neil Ardley, the team won, and he said that after he said that his press conference, I was reading about it. It's a great story. And a fan had emailed him saying how bad the team were, how disconsolate the supporters were, and what the fans wanted from the players. And he used that as the basis of his team talk. They went and won. Stories like that, it could be at the bottom of the footballing pyramid in England, or it could be Manchester City with Pep Guardiola, you know, the top of the Premier League. So hopefully it's just getting those stories and communicating them and bringing football alive. That's what I enjoy doing.
Well, thanks very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Lovely to speak to you.
Thanks.